Hello, this is Bill DeFazio. Dina is not here today, and we have a wonderful, wonderful show planned. This is City Watch. City Watch is a watchdog for social, economic, and cultural issues in New York City and post-democratic America. Today we have Dr. Rod Bush, the author of We Are Not What We Seem, Black Nationalism and Class Struggle in the American Century, NYU Press, and a professor at St. John's University. The racism of man-made horrors of Katrina in the Gulf hit us all in the gut. Has the atmosphere created by the Bush administration and the weakness of the Democratic Party brought back the old racism of America's past, or is this a new postmodern racism? And after that, we will have Mark Berkey-Girard, the city government editor for Gotham Gazette, who will analyze the Democratic primaries and can Ferrer or Wiener, beat Mayor Bloomberg in November. And with that, hello, Rod. How are you doing?
Good morning, Bill. I'm fine. How are you?
I'm fine. It's good to talk to you. I've already said who you are and what you do. You're a professor at St. John's University and an author. You also have a new book that you're working on. What's the new book called, Rod?
The new book is going to be entitled The End of White World Supremacy, Black Internationalism and the Problem of the Color Line. Some folks say that that's a pretty optimistic title, but, you know.
Why optimistic? Why do they think it's optimistic?
Well, because they obviously think that white supremacy is as much with us as it has always been. My position is that it is not. It's certainly still strong. But the power of the white world, as Malcolm X predicted in 1963, is on the wane. And even if that means that they have to reformulate their ideas in other ways, it still means that the power of the dark world has been rising, but the white world is still very much with us. So in that sense, you might say Malcolm X was very optimistic in 1963 because of what he was seeing happening there in terms of decolonization and so forth.
But, now, I put out in the publicity, let me interrupt for a second, I put out in the publicity the kind of the third sentence from The Souls of Black Folk, because I started off my social theory course at St. John's by using The Soul of Black Folk to introduce the social theory course. And as you know, at the beginning of that book, he's asked, how does it feel to be a problem? And he says, how does it feel to be a problem? He says, I answer seldom a word. But you know that he thought that the race problem was the problem for the 20th century in the United States of America. Is it the problem still for the 21st century? Or is it an irrelevant question now?
Well, I don't think that it's the same problem as it was at the turn of the 19th century, the turn from the 19th to the 20th century. I think that with the decolonization of most formal colonies, that the relationship between the white world and the dark world has changed the formation of the United Nations and the ability of the dark world to and somewhat contend with the, I want to change the formulation here, the Western capitalist powers, is greater than it was before. But, you know, the power imbalance is still significant. Not only significant, it's dramatic. And we all know that. But there has been a change. And the space that has developed as a consequence of the decolonization, which in the 1960s and 70s we thought was much greater, has turned out to be not so great. But still, it's a space for contention, and that increases the ability of black people and other people of color to contend with white supremacy. And so I'm not saying that, you know, it's over. Far from it. I'm saying that it's declining. And so this gives me and others, I think, a sense of hope that we can change a world that depends upon the subordination and demonization of the majority of the world's population. Du Bois said that the faith in humanity demands a faith in black men. He used men. Of course, we know a faith in people of color in general. So who are the majority of the people? So in that sense is what my new book is going to be focusing on, is the extent to which the black freedom struggle has developed a internationalist approach, which used to be pretty much associated with the World Socialist Movement. But my argument is that the black freedom struggle has developed a sense of internationalism that's important in terms of trying to link us, not just black folks, but all of us, to you know, humanity all over the world, and to seeing, you know, the sense in which our fates are intertwined, and the sense in which we need to be able to stand up for one another and not use the idea that some people are alien or different to justify their low position, in some cases horribly low positions in poverty, because somehow they aren't civilized enough, or they aren't, you know, they don't have the skills or the culture that's needed to be able to enter into the mainstream. So that's my point, that looking for human solidarity on a very broad scale, beyond the philosophy and ideology of white supremacy.
Now, the racism of the man-made horrors of Katrina in the Gulf hit us all in the gut, right?
Yeah.
And I worry that the atmosphere created by the Bush administration and the weakness of the Democratic Party has caused a resurgence in racism. Sometimes I call it politically correct racism. Sometimes I call it postmodern racism. Or is this just the same old racism? But it seems to be like racism with a new vengeance, Rod. Am I just a, you know, an outsider over exaggerating?
Well, I think that if you look historically at the way that the U.S. has dealt with racism, is that the story is it's pretty much like this. Is that once we were a slave society, we abolished slavery over a great war. Then we had Jim Crow in the South, and the nation, but the overall relationship between groups was one that was governed by a sense of people come to the country. They learn the skills and so forth that they need. They learn the culture. And then they are discriminated against at first, but then they're gradually assimilated into the mainstream of American society. Most people agree that this was not the case for blacks, but that eventually, with the rise of the civil rights movement in the 50s and 60s, and the challenge that Martin Luther King issued to the nation in 1963, the nation did, in fact, rise up to live out the true meaning of its creed. And so, and then what happened is that the blacks and other people of color became very militant and used some tactics that alienated the majority of white society. So you had a backlash against the racial progress. And that backlash has been in force since the 1970s, when the Republican Party used the Southern strategy to gather a majority in the electorate, or at least, if not a majority, then a majority of the people who were likely to vote. And so Kevin Phillips wrote a book called The Emerging Republican Majority, to sort of galvanize this group and around a particular strategy, which they call the Southern Strategy. So that strategy has been enforced, and in 1980, the Reagan administration argued that we have dealt with the issue of racism, that racism today is practiced only by people of color and those people who support color-conscious methods in order to eliminate racism, and they're actually practicing reverse discrimination. And so this became the main line of racism in the post-1980s period, and it has remained so. Now what we see is the rise of a new, more virulent form of racism that is really just under the surface in the reaction to the initial reactions to the way that the conservatives try to conceptualize what's happening, particularly in New Orleans.
We saw all those black bodies floating in the river, and we saw all those, not that there weren't stranded white people, et cetera, but most of the people we saw stranded seemed to be black people.
Well, yes, that's very true. Now, what I think is that what they were doing was they were carrying on business as usual, and they were going on their whole idea of colorblindness, which is, you know, it's not just about color, because the black freedom struggle was a challenge to inequality in general. And the problem that the powers that be had with the black freedom struggle was not the issue of skin color per se, but it was the problem of a people who were demanding a more egalitarian society for all people. And so the attack on the black freedom struggle was designed to change the concern that had come, that had it was established during the New Deal, although certainly in a racist way, that the society as a whole would promote the general welfare, that government would be used to promote the general welfare, because the economic structure could not be dependent upon to always promote the general welfare, especially when it wasn't functioning well, when things were bad, when it was in a period of stagnation. And so that idea was under attack, and it was the black freedom struggle that pushed in the 1960s for the acceptance of people of color into this conception of the common good. And the powers that be wanted to end entitlement. So the idea of colorblindness was to end the idea that people were entitled to jobs, to housing, to health care, to all of the things that, you know, a decent society would provide for people. And so that was the basis, in my view, of the attack on the black freedom struggle and the emergence of this idea of what some of us call colorblind racism. So, but I think what has happened in the situation in the Gulf, particularly in New Orleans, when black people are suffering, is that the present administration, who were adamant that government should play less and less of a role in terms of providing for the common good, wanted to basically ignore what happened. And of course, I think people responded on a very gut level in terms of seeing what was happening. And so I think that it was a miscalculation that they could proceed with business as usual. And I think it was a miscalculation, and they are now responding, trying to do damage control. But I think that it really was a miscalculation because, as I said, even though things are changing slowly, you know, this kind of these images, these terrible, terrible images, is not something that people accept in terms of a vision of what American society is about. And as skeptical as some of us may be about that, I think that people do have an idea, and the idea of what American society is about is real. And so the callousness of the people who wanted to sit by and demonize, simply demonize the poor black residents of New Orleans, it hit people in a way that, hey, you know, there's something that's terribly callous about this. And so the administration is now, I think, on the defensive and trying to correct that. But of course, we know that what happened in New Orleans is simply a result of the policies that have been pursued with a vengeance since 1980, when Reagan took power, but started in the late 1960s and early 1970s with the backlash to the egalitarian movement of the civil rights movement and the demand that all God's children want to be free and that we're all entitled to a decent life.
Now, yesterday at the Roberts hearings, Senator Kennedy asked Roberts one of the many questions that Roberts refused to answer. You know, he always has an excuse, and he's always charming. He always has a smile on his face, but Roberts refuses to answer. And actually, Kennedy, unlike most of the Democrats, really got angry about it and then got scolded by Arlen Specter, Senator Specter, for not letting Roberts not answer. The extension of the Voting Rights Act is coming up now. It's time for that, and Roberts was asked about how he felt about the extension of the Voting Rights Act, and he refused to answer it. I do believe it'll be extended, but maybe I'm naive, but that it's such an issue and that it is being contested in certain parts of the country to the extent that it is being contested is that just an indicator of this continuous Southern strategy, or is this an indicator, again, of what I feel is that Bush has created an atmosphere where racism is all right again? Doesn't have to be hidden so much anymore.
Well, I believe that the opposition to not the Voting Rights Act as a whole, but to certain elements of the Voting Rights Act is in opposition to the attempt to assist people who might have problems voting to have the franchise. I think that this is part of the whole colorblind notion that there should be no sort of special help, is that people should have the right to vote, and that's it. Now, we know that the right to vote was interfered with by not directly by saying, well, you can't vote. There were all kinds of mechanisms used to keep black folks from voting. So I think the opposition to certain elements of the Voting Rights Act is to enable what is actually happening now with what the Bush administration has done over the last two elections, is to actually decrease the availability of the franchise for people who won't vote for them. I mean, the issue of felons, of course, is the major thing. And the whole issue of incarceration being used as a mechanism of disenfranchising black people, Latinos, and other people of color is very much a part of the common sense of the right wing these days. So is it a continuation of the Southern strategy? Yes, it is. Is it in some ways a new strategy? Of course, the tactics evolve as the old strategies come up against people who are opposed to them and trying to seek ways to get around those strategies so that new strategies are evolved within, you know, a new context. And the new context, of course, which I think has been around since at least the 1980s, is the arrival at some kind of consensus, at least for a while, about the using the market, which is what that's what Reagan's position, not only in terms of for economic purposes, but using it for policy purposes as well, which is simply, you know, absurd from our point of view. But that's what they're trying to do. And they're using market ideology in so many realms, in education, for example. So so is it new? Is it a continuation? I would argue that it's both a continuation with elements of a new hard edge. But, you know, that hard edge, I think, maybe, my opinion, is that it's an overreach. And I think just as Newt Gingrich and the revolutionaries of 1994 had their contract with America, and they strayed somewhat from using the race line, and they talked about abolishing guarantees that benefit the real universal entitlements that are not entirely universal, but they attacked these universal entitlements, and people rebelled against them, and they lost. And I think that that what we're seeing here is a breach. My view is that what we see here is a breach in the conservative coalition, where there's a, you know, fairly large group of people who are not going to accept the meanness. You know, Bush has gotten over because he articulates this notion of compassionate conservatism. Well, there's nothing compassionate about what they were doing in the immediate aftermath of the Hurricane Katrina. And I think that that there's that reaction then is going to rein them in. They're going to try to. They're going to, of course, try to do damage control. But we'll see how successful that is.
Now I want to go back in time for a little while. And the Emmett Till movie has been playing at the Film Forum. I don't know if it's still there. And I was in my fourth grade class in 1955 reading about Emmett Till, the murder of Emmett Till, in my weekly reader. Hard to believe that we started current events so young in those days. Now we protect kids from these things. But there I was naively thinking about how lucky I was to be in the North, as if there was no racism in the North, and that's what I believed. And you were growing up in the South. I don't know if you know how aware you were of Emmett Till. But what was your boyhood like in the South in terms of being a young black boy in the South?
Well, it's depressing to remember those days. There are good things about it in terms of what we did as a community, as a culture, in terms of trying to strengthen ourselves, raise ourselves up. But the Jim Crow South was a... a very repressive system. It required us to undergo a certain sort of demeaning rituals in the presence of white folks. We had to say yes, sir, no, sir, yes, ma'am, no, ma'am. We couldn't look them in the eye. we had to step off the sidewalk if there was a group of whites coming towards you. And you had to accept insults from anyone, any white person. I can recall being in the drugstore in the place where blacks were allowed, and a little white kid about 3 years old walked up and kicked me in the shin and said, "You're a nigger, aren't you?" And of course, you know, what could I say except for yes, sir? You know, if you didn't, you could be, your family could lose their jobs. You could lose your life. And I know a lot of people who, in fact, lost their lives. But in school, we weren't taught about current events that, as they applied to race, the position of black people. We were taught Booker T. Washingtonism. I always say, well, you know, I didn't learn civics because we couldn't vote. What I learned was Booker T. Washingtonism. That is how you please white people, how you be more conscious, more honest, and scrupulous in honesty than anyone, because they were always testing you to see if you would steal. And so you had to work, you know, three times as hard. You know, so what we learned was Booker T. Washingtonism. So the civil rights movement was a very distant, in fact, not a part of what I understood, although there were things going on, even in Florida. But the civil
Where in Florida were you, Rod?
I was in the Orlando area, little town called Oviedo, about 15, that at that time was about 15 miles northeast of Orlando, which now is right on the border. You know, they're right on the border of Orlando because both towns have grown with the, you know, the influence of Disney and so forth in that area. But there were, you know, things going on in Florida that, you know, we weren't aware of. Maybe the adults knew about them. But we didn't talk about those things in schools. We didn't talk about those things in church, from what I remember.
Yeah. You know, there's this other thing that goes on, which is my reaction. I'm a little boy thinking that, well, I'm in the North. How lucky I am. There's no racism here. I live near the Sheepshead Projects, and I did have black friends and all of that, but there's a kind of taken-for-granted racism, it's what I call it, that well-meaning whites often have as well, that they're often unconscious about. If you're an African-American, or if you're a member of any oppressed group, you never can take it for granted. But it's in that taken-for-granted racism. I always think that really helps to maintain that naive racism that existed among liberals and people of the left, even white people of the left, in the 1950s and 60s, that sustained racism. This is something we'll have to talk about at another time, Rod, because we've run out of time, as much as I've enjoyed this.
Okay.
And we will have to continue this at some time in the future.
Okay.
I'd also like you to help help Dina and I produce some shows on this issue in the future as well.
Okay.
Okay? Thank you very much.
All for it. Okay.
Dr. Rod Bush.
Okay.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Bye.